KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The only safe approach is to not talk about the market before announcing policy changes that will have a dramatic impact.
Democrats have questions about a social media post Trump made hours before he announced a pause on tariffs.
For Thursday, April 10th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour to New England, where morning bird song used to be a sign of spring.
Now as the climate warms, new birds are filling the sky with songs all year round.
They're making a ton of noise. They're fighting amongst each other so that then when the females show up, the males will already have their territories claimed.
Later, Blink-182's Mark Hoppus looks back on his band's ups and downs.
After two breakups, he explains how the trio moved past all the small things.
We just went and we said, we want to only do what we want to do. Don't come to us with any nonsense. We're going to ride this out to the end. Blink-182 forever.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Supreme Court says the Trump administration should facilitate the return to the U.S. of a Maryland man who was mistakenly deported to El Salvador and remains in custody there. The decision is a notable win for those challenging the administration's deportation orders, but the court sent the case back to the district court judge to clarify one aspect of the decision, quote, with due regard for the deference owed to the executive branch in the conduct of foreign affairs. The Trump administration claimed Kilmore Abrego-Garcia is a member of the MS-13 gang, though his attorneys say he's never been charged or convicted of a crime. And an immigration judge had ruled he should not be deported. The Trump administration is revoking hundreds of visas for international students, many of whom have been involved in protests against the war in Gaza. Those having their visas revoked include a small number from Indiana University, some of whom were involved in union activism. Ethan Sandweiss from member station WFIU has more.
Hey, hey, ho, ho! We don't want our friends to go! Hey, hey!
IU students and faculty organized this protest. The university says it wasn't told why the visas were revoked. At least two of the students have protested for recognition of a graduate student workers union. One international student at the protest says he'll keep exercising free speech despite the risks. Kwan requested we use only his first name for fear of reprisal by federal authorities.
I was involved with the graduate workers union as well as other, you know, activism, social activism on campus. And I just think that it's important for me to do the right thing, you know, in this environment.
The university says it's helping students, quote, to the extent it can. For NPR News, I'm Ethan Sandweiss in Bloomington, Indiana.
While President Trump has put a temporary pause on some tariffs, many remain in place. That includes a 25% tax on imported cars that kicked in last week. But cars on lots now are not affected by the tariffs, leaving would-be car buyers with a choice, as we hear from NPR's Camila Domonoske.
Last month was the best month for new car sales in 4 years. Cars already on dealer lots aren't affected by tariffs. That's a few months' supply, and in fact, some companies are offering deals. Kira Ney was planning to get a car next year.
But with the tariffs and so much of the uncertainty about that, we just decided that we couldn't wait any longer.
She says the dealership was packed when she and her husband bought their new SUV. Of course, if prices go up, as expected in the coming months, sales will slow. And while new car prices aren't up yet, used car prices are already starting to rise. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Ahead of the imposition of the Trump administration tariffs, inflation was relatively reined in last month, though economists say that could change. According to the Labor Department, consumer prices were up 2.4% in March from the same period a year ago. Another wild day on Wall Street, the Dow fell more than 1,000 points. You're listening to NPR. Republicans in the House have managed by a narrow margin to push through their budget framework. The 216 to 214 vote today, a turnaround for Speaker Mike Johnson, who had to overcome pushback from hardline GOP lawmakers. Johnson, along with his Senate counterpart John Thune, claimed calming the budget hawks by saying they're on track to seek at least $1.5 trillion in spending cuts. Americans going to Brazil will now need a visa to enter the country as of today. The same goes for citizens from Canada and Australia. As Julia Carnaros reports from Rio de Janeiro.
A strong Trump ally, Brazil's former president Jair Bolsonaro had granted visa exemptions to travelers from the U.S., Canada, and Australia to boost tourism. But after 6 years of that, visitors from these countries will again require entrance visas. This decision was made 2 years ago and only now comes into effect. The policy is based on reciprocity. If nations demand a visa from Brazilians, the country does the same. But the tourism industry fears this may discourage travel. Last year, more than 700,000 Americans visited Brazil. Travelers can request the new visas online at the cost of $80.90. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro in Rio de Janeiro.
Known for decades-old marketing campaigns that involve handing out sweepstakes wins, Publishers Clearinghouse has filed for Chapter 11. The company is filing in New York this week, saying it's using the bankruptcy process to finalize a shift away from its legacy business of direct mail, moving more toward a pure digital ad model. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The U.S. Supreme Court tonight issued an emergency order. It requires the Trump administration to, quote, facilitate the release of a Maryland man who was mistakenly deported to El Salvador due to an administrative error. But the court sent back the case to the federal district court judge with words of caution not to exceed her authority. Joining us now to explain is NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Hi, Nina.
Hi there, Elsa.
Okay, so just remind us real quick about the facts in this case.
Gilmar Armando Abrego Garcia is a Salvadoran citizen who's lived in Maryland for almost 14 years. While he initially entered the U.S. without being granted legal status, a federal judge in 2019, an immigration judge, granted him protection from being deported because of concerns for his safety if he were to return to El Salvador. As far as we know, he has no criminal record, and he's led an exemplary life. In March, he was on his way home from work in Baltimore with his 5-year-old son in the back seat when he was stopped by ICE agents who quickly deported him to El Salvador and a mega prison there. A Justice Department official subsequently admitted in court that Abrego Garcia's deportation was a, quote, administrative error. That lawyer was subsequently put on leave by the Trump administration.
Okay, and how did the Supreme Court respond in this case?
The justices said that the government must now, quote, facilitate Abrego Garcia's release from custody in El Salvador and must handle his case as it would have been handled had he not been improperly sent to El Salvador.
Wait, so what does that mean?
Good question. I think it basically means that the district court judge is supposed to superintend this process, but has to do so without exceeding her authority. In short, as the court put it, the judge must clarify her directive, quote, with due regard for the deference owed to the executive branch in the conduct of foreign affairs. And the court said that the government, for its part, should be prepared to share what it can concerning the steps it has taken and the prospect of further steps.
So, Nina, who would you say won and who lost here?
Well, I think probably this is a shot across the bow of the administration and the lower courts not to get out of their lanes. The government isn't supposed to stiff the courts or lie to them, and the courts are to accord deference to the executive branch in dealing with foreign countries. And so it's not entirely clear. It's probably a compromise between the conservative justices, because the three liberal justices certainly were not happy with this outcome, but they signed on to it because, you know, in the end, the government's going to try to have to get him home.
Wait, did any justice dissent, though?
Nobody dissented, but the three liberals noted that to this day the government has not cited any basis for Abrego Garcia's warrantless arrest or his removal to El Salvador or his confinement in prison, and that because he was protected by the 2019 court order, this was an egregious violation of his rights, they said, landing him in prison in El Salvador for 26 days so far. Therefore, the three said, that because every factor governing requests for equitable relief manifestly weigh against the government, they, the three, would have declined to intervene in the lower court judge's order at all. And by the way, NPR has reached out to the White House for comment, but so far at this time, we don't have any response.
That is NPR's Nina Totenberg. Thank you so much, Nina.
Thanks, Elsa.
President Trump's chaotic tariff policy is spooking investors again. The Dow closed down just over 1,000 points one day after Trump announced a 90-day pause on many of his new tariffs. Now, a social media post that he made yesterday, hours before announcing that pause, has raised accusations of improprieties, such as market manipulation and insider trading. Some Democratic lawmakers are calling for an investigation. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen joins us now to explain. Hi, Maria.
Hey there.
Okay, so these are pretty serious accusations, right? Like, just catch us up on why there are calls for an investigation.
It's kind of a tale of two social media posts.
Okay.
Yesterday morning, shortly after the U.S. stock market opened, President Trump posted on his Truth Social network in all caps, "This is a great time to buy." Now, as you remember, the stock market had been tumbling for days after Trump unveiled his tariff plan on virtually every country last week. So at first, this post could have looked like a run-of-the-mill confidence booster. But then, less than 4 hours later, Trump said he would pause most of those tariffs.
Right.
Stocks immediately shot up in relief, with the Dow closing up almost 3,000 points. So if you had, in fact, followed Trump's advice in the morning and bought into the stock market right away, you would have made a lot of money by the end of the day.
Right.
Now, the White House said in a statement that Trump was just trying to reassure the markets and Americans, but it's this sequence of events that has led Democrats and others to call for investigations.
And what are they alleging exactly?
They're saying that Trump may have been trying to deliberately manipulate the markets or to enable others to trade on insider knowledge before it became public. Senators Adam Schiff and Ruben Gallego sent a letter to the White House and asked the Office of Government Ethics to probe who knew what in advance. Senator Elizabeth Warren also called for an investigation. She asked on the floor of Congress if this was, quote, corruption in plain sight. But, Elsa, it's important to note this isn't just a partisan matter. I spoke this morning to Richard Painter at the University of Minnesota. He was also the chief ethics lawyer for President George W. Bush. And he told me that if anyone in the Bush administration had done this, that person probably would have been fired.
We can't have senior public officials, including the president, talking about stock prices and where to buy or to sell at the same time as they are making and announcing decisions that have a dramatic impact on stock prices.
Wait, wait, wait. Is that Painter's way of saying that there was market manipulation?
Not quite. Painter says there's not clear evidence of that. But he does say that Trump's post on Truth Social raised serious questions and should be investigated. He also points out that Trump already has a track record of pushing the boundaries at the very least.
Financial conflicts of interest for President Trump have been a concern since he was first elected in 2016.
And now he says the problems are even greater. For example, the president has embraced the crypto industry and promised much more crypto-friendly regulation at a time that he and his family have a lot of crypto business interests.
Hmm. Well, what can we expect will happen next at this point?
Not much. I mean, Republicans do control both the House and the Senate, and they've shown little interest in picking fights with Trump. And again, the White House says Trump was just trying to reassure the markets. Now, normally the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission investigates accusations of insider trading, but the SEC declined to comment. And Trump has issued an executive order to try to exert more control over independent federal agencies. So it seems unlikely we'll see much happen.
That is NPR's Maria Aspen. Thank you, Maria.
Thank you.
As winter loosens its cold grip on New England, morning birdsong fills the air even before the sun comes up. But as the climate warms, backyard birds once seen as signs of spring are now year-round residents. Maine Public Radio's Peter McGuire takes us out on a chilly morning to witness the change.
These birds we're hearing right now are males. It tends to be males that do most of the singing.
Maine Audubon's Doug Hitchcock cranes his head to catch sight of red-winged blackbirds bobbing and diving in the woods outside the group's headquarters. It's a bitter morning, and the blackbirds are getting ready for nesting season.
They're making a ton of noise, they're fighting amongst each other, so that then when the females show up, the males will already have their territories claimed.
Red-winged blackbirds are a sure sign spring is coming, or at least they used to be.
It was always, you know, kind of the first week of March, red-winged blackbirds would come back. And then, you know, a couple of years later, it was like the, you know, one of the last weeks of February. Then a couple of years later, mid-February.
Then 2 years ago, he says, Maine birders reported seeing red-winged blackbirds every single week of the year.
These are still, you know, a small number of birds, but it's definitely, I think, kind of an early indicator of some of the changes that are going on here.
Climate change accelerated by fossil fuel pollution is tempering New England's notoriously fierce winters. That's helped alter the kinds of birds people see in their neighborhoods. Take the eastern bluebird, which used to migrate north as the weather warmed up. Now they're common and abundant in southern parts of Maine all winter long. And there's newcomers to get acquainted with. Less than a generation ago, sighting a red-bellied woodpecker sent a buzz through the birding community. Now, the historically southern birds are commonplace. Hitchcock says Carolina wrens, little brown birds with an outsized song, frequently generate midwinter calls from birders misled by out-of-date field guides.
Up until like the 80s or so, Carolina wrens were barely into southern New England. So a lot of people see, you know, an old map like that and just think like, oh, this bird, it shouldn't be here. But that's really what the change has been.
This move north is happening across the country. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, the center of the winter range for hundreds of common bird species has moved north 40 miles since the 1960s. But it's also hard to pin expanding bird ranges on just one thing. John Garrett is from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York.
What's really tricky is it's often really hard to disentangle what's climate change versus, you know, all of these other things that humans do that affect bird populations.
So habitat changes like regrown woodlands and suburban development give expanding species toeholds in new areas. Eastern bluebirds in particular got a boost from a birdhouse building program. And feeders full of seeds, suet, and mealworms help backyard birds weather the ever-shortening cold season. For NPR News, I'm Peter McGuire.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Mark Hoppus met his best friend on the same day he moved to San Diego for college. He says they were both just Southern California skateboarders who dreamed of making art. It helped that Mark Hoppus played bass and Tom DeLonge played guitar.
From the day that I met Tom, he was like a dear friend, and we had the same sense of humor, the same musical sensibilities. Even today, like 30-something years later, Tom and I get in a room together and we're just laughing and trying to make each other, trying to outdo one another with jokes, and he's just awesome. Now, and it's happened once again. I'll turn
to a friend, someone that understands. This was the 90s, and their bromance became a rock band, a trio called Blink, eventually Blink 182. After years of living out of a touring van, their record company got acquired by a major label, even if label executives did not love their forthcoming album.
When we brought it in, we started playing them songs, and one by one, all the people walked out. It was great. Well, I guess this is growing up.
Blink-182 did get on the radio with the song Damn It and with a new drummer named Travis Barker. They would soon explode into the mainstream with their next recording. And all of this is chronicled in Mark Hoppus's new memoir, Fahrenheit 182. He writes about the rise and fall of his band through the lens of his friendship with Tom DeLonge. In 1999, Mark, Tom, and Travis were riding high with smash hits like What's My Age Again?
First of all, I think it's a great song. It's a song that I started writing as a joke song, just for my friends, and then with Tom and Travis's encouragement, turned it into a real song that I think is a great representation of Blink-182. You know, coming out of the mid to late 90s, pop was really big. You know, boy bands, NSYNC, and I think people were ready for a little more edge and a little more fun. So Blink-182 came around, and I think it was just being there at the right moment when people were ready to laugh. And I think that What's My Age Again really broke through what was being played on the radio because it was catchy, it has a lot of energy, it had a funny video.
I was kind of laughing to myself when I was reading the part of the book where you talk about how this is what cemented Blink's status as the naked band.
Yeah. Marco Siega, the director of What's My Age Again, he went to his nephew and said, you know, I'm going to direct a video by Blink-182, what do you know about them? He's like, oh, they're silly and they're about whatever. And so Marco's like, okay, what about a video where you run naked through Los Angeles? We're like, sure, sounds funny. We can make a joke out of that. And then we did that, and it was such a huge hit that when we did All the Small Things video, we were like, oh, let's do a throwback to the What's My Age Again video, and we'll do a thing where we run naked across the beach. And then that video got super huge. And then people were like, oh, do this photo shoot, but like, take off your pants and like cover yourselves up. We do that. And then it just kind of became a thing. And once it started to become a thing, then we were like, we don't want to do that anymore. That's dumb. Even to this day, people are like, you guys gonna play naked tonight? And we're like, we're in our 40s, 50s now. What are you talking about? Carry me home.
The band has gone through a lot of twists and turns in terms of the personnel. You talk a lot in the book about your relationship with Tom, who left the band twice. The first time was in 2005. And I have to say, the way that you write about it at that time, it's very clear that for you and for him, this is more than just a band breaking up. Y'all had been best friends and creative partners for so long. Can you describe what that felt like?
It felt like my world had ended. It felt like I had gotten divorced, like someone had died. It felt like a huge sense of loss. Outside of my marriage and my son at that point, I had nothing else. And to think that Tom would not want to do that was heartbreaking to me, and I felt betrayed, and I really spun out for a while there. I lost a lot. Writing this book and thinking back to all the hard times, I don't know that we would be where we are right now without having gone through what we did, the lows especially.
You just write in so much detail about those hard times, the first time Tom left the band, the second time, sort of the emotional journey that you went through. It left me wondering, were you able to have a conversation, the two of you and Travis, about why the friction happened, why you guys had to take some time apart? Were you able to have that dialogue?
Both times that the bands gotten back together were due to horrible tragedies. The first one was Travis's plane crash. Mm-hmm. And I think that at that moment, Tom realized what was really important to him was our band and our friendship. And so that kind of brought us all back together. And then we were together for a number of years, and then Tom quit again. And then I got sick with cancer.
Yeah.
And literally the day before I started chemotherapy, just by chance, Tom texted me a joke. And I was like, haha, that's awesome. Stoked for you. By the way, I start chemotherapy tomorrow. I have cancer. And immediately my phone rang, and it was Tom. And he was like, first of all, I love you, and you're going to get better. You're going to get through this. I'm going to see you through this. We're going to get you better, and we're going to write the album of our careers. And so on the other side of getting better from cancer, and we started to, obviously, it was in the air. Are we going to get the band back together? What's going to happen? We all sat down and had a really great talk. We just went and we said, we want to only do what we want to do. Don't come to us with any nonsense. We're going to ride this out to the end. Blink-182 forever.
Where are you? And I'm so sorry. I cannot sleep. I cannot dream tonight. I need somebody.
Near the end of the book, there's this moment where y'all get called in last minute to play Coachella after Frank Ocean dropped out. And there's this huge crowd. It's this big moment. Y'all have been at this for so many decades, and yet so much of how people see and talk about Blink is kind of about this vibe of, I don't know, youthful irreverence. How have you been thinking about that and the music that you've been making recently?
Well, we've always tried to balance Blink's comedy and youthful irreverence and, you know, silliness with heartfelt lyrics and heartfelt songs. And if you listen to the record, there's songs like Adam's Song and there's deeper songs.
I never thought I'd die alone. I laugh the loudest, who'd have known?
The people who get Blink-182 know that there's a duality to Blink-182, that we write really heartfelt stuff that's important to us, but we will also write a song like, you know, What's My Age Again?
Because you mentioned Adam's Song, I do want to ask you about it. I know that it's a song that came from a challenging place for you in your own mental health, and I'm just curious, what does that song mean for you today? What's your relationship with it now, all these years later?
When we first got the band back together and we were touring last year, we would play that song and I would talk about it beforehand and I would say, this song saved my life when I wrote it. And this band, when I got sick with cancer, saved my life a second time. And I'm doing it right now. But it makes me choke up and it makes me appreciate everything so much more. And it makes me appreciate my band and the love that we feel from people when we perform live.
We've been speaking with Mark Hoppus of Blink-182. His memoir, Fahrenheit 182, is out now. Mark, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
A new streaming series focuses on a hedge fund manager who loses his job and turns to robbing his rich friends. It's also about how wealth can disappear in an instant.
If all of this stuff is so ephemeral, then why do we ascribe so much meaning to it? Does it define us?
Actor Jon Hamm on his new show, Your Friends and Neighbors, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The finale of this season of The Pitt airs tonight on Max.
It has become the most watched show on Max since its debut.
I think the consensus among the doctors and nurses that I have heard talking about The Pitt is that it's a lot closer to what they actually experience.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. President Trump has backed down on some of his biggest tariffs, but many remain in place, including a staggering 145% tariff on Chinese goods. China is retaliating, and that has the White House once again considering how to help American farmers. Here's NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben.
U.S. tariffs can make farm supplies more expensive, while foreign tariffs mean farmers sell less overseas. As a result, Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins says Trump is considering direct payments to farmers. It's something he did during his first term trade dispute with China. John Peel, who farms in northern Illinois, says those payments were helpful, but
that was just for the 1 year. What about the market loss that continued through his term and into Biden's term? I think the amount is incredible.
U.S. soybean exports to China plummeted in Trump's first term, and they haven't recovered, as China has bought more soy from Brazil instead. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
Civil rights groups are asking a federal court to allow them to defend the U.S. Census Bureau in a lawsuit led by the state of Louisiana. It comes as the White House considers a plan to alter the 2030 census results. NPR's Hansi Luong reports.
There's a key set of census results used to determine how presidents and members of Congress are elected. The 14th Amendment says those results must include the, quote, whole number of persons in each state. But Republican officials in Louisiana, Kansas, Ohio, and West Virginia filed a lawsuit to try to force the Census Bureau to exclude U.S. residents without legal status and those with visas. A judge paused the case after the Trump administration said it needed time to reconsider its approach because of one of President Trump's executive orders. It revoked one from the Biden administration that affirmed the Constitution's census requirements. Now the League of Women Voters, represented by the Southern Poverty Law Center, is asking the judge to let them step in to defend the Census Bureau's policy of counting every person living in the United States.
This is NPR. Sudan has launched a case at the International Court of Justice against the United Arab Emirates. It accuses the country of funding and supporting a genocide. The UAE deny the claims, as we hear from NPR's Emmanuel Akinwutu.
Sudan has told the ICJ the UAE is violating the Genocide Convention by supporting the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. The RSF and allied Arab militias have been widely accused by the UN and others of committing a genocide against Masalits and other ethnic groups. The United States has also accused the RSF of genocide, and the Biden administration said it had received assurances from the UAE it will no longer fund the RSF. Investigations by several rights groups has found the UAE has been arming the RSF via Sudan's borders with Chad and South Sudan, but the UAE strongly denies this. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News.
Security experts have some tips for travelers as scrutiny of tech devices increases when crossing borders, including coming back into the U.S. Some of the recommendations to protect your privacy include putting your cell phone in airplane mode when you get to the border to stay disconnected from the internet. Use passcodes and PINs instead of biometrics to access your device. And if you have to bring your laptop across the border, store any sensitive data in the cloud and then delete it from the device. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Since Israel ended its ceasefire in Gaza last month, the military has been slicing up the territory in a move it says will pressure Hamas to release more Israeli hostages. Its latest operation cuts off an entire city in the south from the rest of the strip. Joining us now to explain is NPR correspondent Aya Batraoui in Dubai. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So Israel's military says it is separating all of southern Gaza from the rest of the territory. How is it doing this?
So throughout the war, there had been a dividing line already separating the north of Gaza from the rest of the territory. And you might recall, you know, hundreds of thousands of people being able to return north during the ceasefire. Now there's another dividing line for the south. Now, Defense Minister Israel Katz, he met with Israeli troops in the southern city of Rafah yesterday in Gaza. And he said the entire southern region would be turned into a security buffer zone and said that is what we are doing now. Now, this impacts an area that was home to around 250,000 people before the war. The takeover of this city, Juana, and its entire surrounding territory swallows a huge portion of Gaza and would fundamentally alter the map. Even when Israel had Jewish settlements in Gaza decades ago, Rafah was Palestinian. It borders Egypt. And until the war, this was Gaza's only land border not controlled just by Israel. And Israel says this is where weapons came in from in tunnels.
I would imagine that this would also impact Egypt, too. So what's their position?
So these are fast moving, and there's been no immediate public reaction to this declaration made yesterday by Israel's defense minister. But it's important to know Egypt says there are no tunnels there, that it destroyed them years ago. But Israeli troop movements throughout the war have been very concerning to Egypt. It has been building up its military presence and defenses across Gaza's border in its Sinai Peninsula. And the military is on high alert, prepared for different scenarios, including the pressure that's been building on Egypt to be part of President Trump and Israel's plan to displace Palestinians out of Gaza, which Egypt clearly rejects.
Rafah was a refuge for more than 1 million people in Gaza during the first months of the war. But then Israel's military invaded Rafah and only during the recent ceasefire allowed Palestinians to return. So why is Israel back there now and pushing them out again?
Well, when Israeli forces were in Rafah the first time, they found hostages in tunnels, and that's where they killed Yahya Sinwar, the mastermind of the October 7th attack on Israel. But it also said that it had defeated Hamas there and dismantled its brigade 6 months ago. And so Israel's government says it's now returning to war, this time to free the remaining hostages, around 20 are believed to be alive, and to eliminate Hamas. But this war aim hasn't been clearly defined, and in an open letter today, hundreds of Israeli reservists and Air Force members, former Air Force members, accuse Israeli government of serving its own political gains, and they were dismissed from serving.
Well, with Israel's forces expanding their ground operations in Gaza, how much territory does the military now control?
So I pose this question to Yaakov Garb. He's a professor at Ben-Gurion University in Israel who's analyzed the military's public maps, and he puts it like this. More than half of Gaza is now inaccessible to Palestinians, and this new Rafah buffer zone constitutes a fifth of Gaza. He says the military is adding new buffer zones to already existing buffer zones that had been carved out during the first part of the war when thousands of buildings were leveled and agricultural land destroyed.
We've shifted to a regime in which you have very extensive areas that are functioning more as large moats around shrinking enclaves of the remaining Gazan population.
So as Israel continues to issue these new evacuation orders, people are being squeezed into smaller areas that are also still being bombed.
That's NPR's Aya Batraoui in Dubai. Thank you.
Thanks, Juana.
Yesterday, President Trump said that he is backing away from some of his highest tariffs, but others remain on certain goods from Canada and Mexico, along with a staggering 145% tariff on Chinese goods. And China has retaliated. It's causing problems for U.S. farmers, so the White House is considering how to help. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben reports.
Tariffs are making life more expensive for John Peel. He's been farming in northern Illinois for more than 50 years.
These tariffs are going to affect everything. It'll affect our parts. Yeah, it's just across the board. It's going to hurt everything.
Peel sums up the double whammy of how tariffs affect farmers. First off, U.S. tariffs make the cost of supplies higher, and it raises the risk of retaliation against exports of U.S. crops.
It's a good way to lose your customers, and I think we'll probably lose more on this round, too, because I know that Mexico is our biggest importer of corn. This time, they may figure out that they can get corn from South America just as easily as from the U.S.
And that's why the White House is considering direct payments to farmers. It's something the Trump administration did during Trump's first-term trade dispute with China. Back then, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue used a fund called the Commodity Credit Corporation, or CCC. Here's current Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins on Fox News this week.
We're already starting to think about what a mitigation effort might look like. Obviously, under Secretary Perdue and President Trump and Trump One, they did do some mitigation with a $25 billion CCC fund. Again, hopefully none of that is necessary.
It's a fund that's been around since the Great Depression, explains Joseph Glauber, a former USDA chief economist.
This was really a new thing that the Trump administration did, is that they tapped the CCC in a way that, and certainly at a level that had not been seen before for extraordinary payments.
NPR asked the White House for details on what relief is under consideration this time, but received no response. Government aid is helpful, but it's not farmers' first choice.
Farmers want markets. We need markets. We want to sell our grain at a profit.
Kenneth Hartman is president of the Corn Board at the National Corn Growers Association. He said that CCC payments are only a short-term fix.
It's supplemental. It's needed because it keeps farmers from getting in worse financial situation. But it's not, you know, them payments are not the answer to a future successful agriculture operation in the United States.
Hartman says he's hopeful about Trump making deals to help farmers.
Well, now with the tariffs coming on, obviously we're hoping that the president, you know, he's a negotiator. He did a good job negotiating the USMCA when he negotiated that his first term. So we're hoping that he can do something like that.
There's another wrinkle to this all, which is timing. All of this tariff drama is unfolding in the spring, when farmers are making decisions about planting big export crops like corn and soybeans. China usually imports a lot of American soybeans, but is also now tariffing U.S. goods at 84%. That means, first of all, a lot of American soybean farmers might decide to grow other crops like corn, which would drive those prices down. But also, an aid package announced too soon might distort markets, says Glauber, the former USDA economist.
Because if you're too generous with one crop vis-a-vis another, you could have farmers making planning decisions based on what they think those compensation payments might be.
Farmers have worries beyond the next year, though. In Illinois, Peel says that the payments in Trump's first term were helpful, but he adds,
that was just for the 1 year. What about the market loss that continued through his term and into Biden's term? I think the amount is incredible.
Soybean exports to China plummeted during Trump's first trade fight with China, and they haven't recovered. China instead chose to buy more from Brazil, and that's still the case now. Peel fears that this trade war will make that worse, so aid payments just might be necessary.
I don't want it, but I'll take it. I'd be an idiot not to take it. That's about all I can say.
Both the U.S. and Chinese tariffs are much higher than they were 6 years ago. Depending on how long they persist, there's no way of knowing just how much they'll hurt farmers. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Two new films, two sets of American operatives in harm's way. The Amateur, a spy thriller starring Rami Malek, goes about his mission with Hollywood flair. Warfare, a battlefield drama set in Iraq, is less flashy. Critic Bob Mondello says, as is often the case, less is more.
The Amateur wants to be a Bourne movie.
I want mission-specific training, cash, and a new identity.
Have you lost your mind?
It stars Rami Malek as an intelligence analyst who can decrypt a message in seconds but has never so much as handled a gun, except now he has a reason.
I want to find and kill the people who murdered my wife.
I don't think you could beat a 90-year-old nun in an arm wrestling match.
Okay, not kind, but also not wrong. Charlie's got to be the nerdiest guy in the CIA. Still, nerds know stuff, like how to get the upper hand when an assassin is in a glass-bottomed swimming pool suspended between skyscrapers. I mean, that can't come up often, but Charlie's ready when it does.
This is a remote that controls a device that's been decompressing the air between the sheets of glass beneath you. If I trigger it, the glass will shatter. So tell me where he is, or swim very fast.
There are three other killers Charlie's going after, and a corrupt CIA old-timer he really should be going after. And Lawrence Fishburne is on hand to supply world-weary common sense as required.
Maybe y'all misjudge this individual.
Filmmaker James Hawes keeps the amateur clicking along competently, if not plausibly, through loose ends, loose characters, and some blather from the head of the CIA about ethics, which sounds awfully precious in the current political environment, quite apart from making you think, come on, guys, have you heard of the CIA? Nobody talks ethics in Warfare, which is set in Iraq in 2006. The film's not about ideologies, politics, or even characters, really. It's about survival in a world where the presence and sound of guns is everywhere.
Oh, he's back.
We're in a covert sniper surveillance unit that's commandeered a residential building, peering with the soldiers through their gun sights.
That's the fourth time he's done that.
They're peeking and probing.
Speaking with serious intent to probe.
With the terrified residents huddled in a bedroom, the Americans try to interpret what they're seeing on the street.
Alpha 2, we might have guys starting to move on our position.
Copy, we're getting a buildup of activity here too.
Yeah, I definitely see weapons at this point.
Yeah, we have definite massing.
If this sounds authentic, it's because it's reconstructed from the memories of men who were there in real life. Alex Garland, co-directing with former Navy SEAL Ray Mendoza, is recreating an actual mission in real time with immersive detail, and even before the first shots are fired, it's intense. Garland is the director of Civil War, last year's portrait of an America divided under a blustering third-term president. Mendoza was a consultant for the battle scenes on that film, and while consulting, he told Garland about coming under fire in Iraq. Augmented with the recollections of his comrades, his memories are the basis for this project.
We have severely wounded.
Who's the severely wounded?
It's not you.
It's me.
The camera rarely moves more than a few feet from the men we're watching.
Are you coming to you or are you coming to us?
Except for a moment when it goes out to the street to show what it means when they call for a show of force and a jet fighter flies terrifyingly low.
Show of force in about 30 seconds.
Sending a shockwave scudding through the streets. The film, so persuasive I forgot at times I wasn't watching a documentary, is designed to put you in the hell these men experience.
Where are you guys?
Look for the blood and the smoke!
And if the absence of context is arguably a flaw, you get that in the heat of battle, global politics would not have been on anyone's mind.
We have enemy on our building and all surrounding buildings.
The film's not really like most Hollywood movies. No talk of heroism, courage, sacrifice. Warfare is just warfare. Calibrated as a cinematic show of force. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Data centers are the backbone of the internet. Tech companies have pledged hundreds of billions of dollars to build new ones, which are often hailed as massive economic development projects. But as Stephen Basaha of the Gulf States Newsroom reports, data centers themselves create few permanent jobs.
There's this stretch of flattened Mississippi land not far from the Alabama border that Lauderdale County has been trying to sell for a quarter century.
Thought we'd drive around, show it to you.
Yeah, please do. Sorry. Bill Hanna is basically the county's chief salesman. Officially, he's the head of the East Mississippi Business Development Corporation. For 25 years, the county just couldn't find the right employer to transform all this grass and red clay into good jobs. But now, finally, Mississippi says it's got the right buyer.
All this stretch of land is about 300 acres, and it's going to be a data center campus.
Think of data centers as the place where the internet and digital economy physically lives. They make it possible for you to store your files in the cloud and run AI applications on your phone. Tech companies often build these centers on cheap rural land, and Mississippi is giving Compass Data Centers 10 years of state tax breaks to build here. For its part, Compass is investing about $10 billion.
This is the largest announcement, not in Meridian and Lauderdale County, but in the state of Mississippi.
Largest announcement, like, what, ever? Or
ever.
Now, this is actually the second $10 billion data center project Mississippi announced in the last year. The state called that the largest economic development project in its history, which sounds like an economy-transforming event, like a car factory bringing in thousands of jobs. But the thing to remember about data centers is that they just don't hire many people.
Most data centers, you know, they employ about 100 to 200 people.
Karthik Hosanagar is the co-director of the Wharton Business School's AI Research Center.
In fact, when Apple created a $1 billion data center in North Carolina, the news stories reported that there were less than 100 permanent jobs created as a result.
That's because, unlike a factory that might need thousands of people to build their product, data centers don't create anything. It's more like a warehouse for computers running on really expensive chips. Compass Data Center spokesperson Katie Hancock said in an email, the company plans to create initiatives to bring Meridian residents into the data center workforce, like the people needed to service those computers. The new center should also boost surrounding businesses like restaurants. But data centers also come with a really important cost that communities need to consider.
Data centers are energy hungry.
Hosanagar says in some states, data centers are consuming up to 5% of all energy used.
It's a lot. And in fact, it's projected in a matter of 2 to 3 years. In most states, it'll be over 10%.
For some communities, keeping up with the power demand just isn't worth the few jobs that come with it. But Mississippi is all in. Mississippi Power agreed to keep burning coal at one of its plants for roughly a decade longer than planned. And for a small city like Meridian, Mississippi, Bill Hanna says the jobs that data centers will create should not be dismissed. After all, this project will be way bigger than your typical data center complex, and it's happening in a city with fewer than 35,000 people.
These types of projects don't have lots of people. When you put 8 buildings out here and put 40 or 50 people in each building, you know, you're at 300 or 400 people. Well, that's significant in a community like Meridian, Mississippi.
And just the work needed to construct a multi-billion dollar facility means lots of jobs for the 7 or so years it'll take to build. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Basaha in Birmingham, Alabama.
Max says that the new medical drama, The Pitt, has been their most watched show globally since it debuted in January. Here's what Dr. Robbie, the senior attending physician in this Pittsburgh emergency room, tells students and interns on their first day on the floor.
As you can see, our house is always packed, and our department is mostly clogged up with boarders. Those are admitted patients waiting for a room upstairs, sometimes for days. Beds are a very precious commodity around here, so please be quick and efficient with your workups.
That is Noah Wiley, who you might recognize from another medical drama, ER. The finale of the season of The Pitt airs tonight on Max. Linda Holmes hosts NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, and she has been loving this season and is here to talk all about it. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
Hello. Okay, let's start with an overview of the show because, you know, it's new. A lot of people have been watching it very, very closely, but not everyone, of course. So just give us what the premise of The Pitt is.
Well, The Pitt is a hospital drama about doctors and nurses and patients. But what makes it unusual is that there are 15 episodes and each one covers 1 hour of a single day. So over the first season, we've followed these folks from 7 a.m. until 10 p.m. And during that time, they've dealt with a lot of ordinary emergencies, but also with a mass shooting that required them to handle a huge influx of patients. So at times it has been very, very intense.
Yeah. And I know that you have been a fan of this show from the start. What do you love about it specifically?
Well, there are a lot of ways to make a doctor show. Some of them are more comic, like Scrubs. Some of them are really focused on the weekly patient stories, which is sort of how ER was. Some of them are more focused on more soapy relationship stuff with the doctors, which is more like what Grey's Anatomy is.
Right.
I think The Pitt has really been about tracking the toll that this work takes on these healthcare providers. So Dr. Robbie, Noah Wiley's character, sort of gradually breaks down over the course of this day from the combination of kind of the regular sad cases that he deals with, of course, this mass casualty event. Plus, there are other big work-related issues because he's got new interns and residents and med students on this particular day. But he's also up against, you know, the hospital bureaucracy that's constantly pushing him to improve patient satisfaction scores and stuff like that, even though, as he points out, it is a hospital and not a fast food place.
Right. So this really intense ecosystem. I feel like people have always been obsessed with medical dramas, right? Like ER launched all these new stars. We're on season 21 of Grey's Anatomy. We just can't get enough, right? Like, how do you think The Pitt compares to all these other long-lasting medical dramas? Like, have elements of this genre changed over the years, you think?
Well, I think the consensus among the doctors and nurses that I have heard talking about The Pitt is that it's a lot closer to what they actually experience with patients than a lot of other shows, which is not to say it's a documentary level of realism at all. Uh-huh. But a lot of the procedures that they do, the attitudes that they run into from patients, that feels closer to their actual experience. And there are things like a patient coming up and just punching a nurse, where I think a lot of people don't necessarily know how common it is for hospital workers to be assaulted at work. And I think hospital shows went out of fashion a little bit during kind of the streaming and cable drama stuff. The Pitt is sort of a cross between that kind of cable or streaming show and more of what hospital shows were like in the network era. So I think it's a little bit of a return to some of the things people liked about traditional TV that maybe were cast aside a little too quickly when streaming took off.
That is Linda Holmes, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Thank you so much, Linda.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at Cunard.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From Total Wine & More, for discovering something new, like a Cabernet or single barrel bourbon. Learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older.